is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150 plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
It comes down to effort. Whether you're a coach or a player, you're going to be rewarded for effort. How much work do you want to put in, and how important is it to be good to you?
Rick Blevins is the boys' varsity basketball coach at Woodridge High School in Peninsula, Ohio. Prior to taking the head job at Woodridge in 2013, Rick was an assistant coach at both Cuyahoga Falls and Warren Howland High Schools. A 1985 graduate of Cortland Maplewood High School in Ohio, Blevins played his college basketball at the University of Rhode Island for two seasons before transferring to Kent State University, where he was my teammate for two seasons under head coach Jim McDonald. Blevins was named first team All-Mid-American Conference in 1990 for the Golden Flashes. Rick is currently in his 26th year teaching physical education in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio. After you finish listening to this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app. Those ratings help others in the basketball community to find our show. Share the Hoopheads podcast with your friends and coaching colleagues so they can listen and learn from some of the best minds in the game from all levels of basketball. Make sure you subscribe to the Hoopheads podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, or YouTube so you never miss an episode. Get ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Rick Blevins, head boys varsity coach at Woodridge High School in Peninsula, Ohio. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel. And tonight, I am pleased to welcome to the podcast my longtime friend, ex-Kent State teammate, current Woodridge boys basketball head varsity coach, Rick Blevins. Rick, welcome.
Thanks, man. I appreciate being on.
And we're excited to have you on, dig into your story, both as a player and as a coach, and all the great things that you've been able to do in the game of basketball. I want to start out by going back to when you were a kid. Just talk to us a little bit about what made you fall in love with the game of basketball when you were young.
Like a lot of kids back in my day, back in the 70s, my first experiences with basketball were, my dad dragging me around to various, city league basketball games that he was playing in as a, 25, 26, 27-year-old guy. Just kind of staying in a corner, dribbling a ball until there was a timeout so I could go chuck it at the basket and come up unsuccessful, I'm sure, on more than one occasion. But, those are my early recollections. And, after that, getting involved in a little bit of organized basketball, probably around the sixth, seventh grade level, and just kind of grew from there.
How much time did you spend as a kid just out on the driveway or at the playground, just shooting by yourself?
Well, I had the luxury of no basketball hoop in my driveway, but my neighbors both had them. So, needless to say, my mom and dad still have two people across the street from them that don't talk to them because I was in their driveway every night. We would wear out. We didn't just wear out nets. We wore out backboards. We wore out rims. That's what there was to do back then. There wasn't a whole lot of other things fighting for my time. And I fell in love with the game pretty early. And wanted to pursue it and wanted to be good. And, you know, I think one of the things that I always kind of prided myself on is nobody ever had to push me to play the game. I wanted to play. I wanted to compete. And I just wanted to be involved.
So what does that look like when you're a 12, 13-year-old kid from your perspective? When you're saying, I wanted to compete, I wanted to get out there, I wanted to get better. What did that look like for you, let's say around, you know, middle school, early high school years for you in terms of how you went about improving your game and getting better? Where did you go to play? How did you structure your practice that you did by yourself? Just talk a little bit about your process.
You know, a lot of it, you kind of see. And, you know, my dad was always great about Tuesdays and Friday nights. You know, we were watching some high school basketball team play. And, you know, back in those days, you could go to the Canton Fieldhouse come tournament time and you could get there Saturday morning at 10:30 and watch games all the way till 7-8 o'clock at night. And, you know, I'd be out of bed first thing Sunday morning. And, you know, I was emulating the guys that I seen play that day, you know, the Andy Timkos and the Dale Blaneys and, you know, guys like that. And, you know, you just kind of pattern yourself after people and, you know, you try to do some of the things that you see them do. And that was what always kind of kept the game interesting for me. You know, getting to the high school level, you know, coming from Warren, you know, that's more of a football town than it is a basketball town. And it was hard to kind of get out and, you know, exposure wasn't anywhere near what it is these days. You had to go out and seek competition. And, you know, fortunately enough, I found some people that got me involved with Five-Star Basketball Camp. And I went over there. I believe I was probably 15 the first year I went over there and just got destroyed. And I don't know why, but at that point I came back home and, you know, instead of licking my wounds, I wanted to make myself better. And, you know, the next summer, I think I went back for two sessions. And I think by the second session, I finally held my own a little bit. And, you know, the year prior to my senior year, I was able to go over there and I had also hit a little bit of a growth spurt, which didn't hurt. But, you know, found myself playing with some really good guys over there and made a good showing for myself. And that kind of led the way for me to, you know, become a college basketball player.
All right. So let's stop and take a little diversion here to Five-Star.
Yeah.
It's one of the conversations that I've had with a bunch of different people who are kind of our age bracket and just how I think people today, if you're a player or a parent of a player, I don't think people really have a good understanding of what Five-Star was. First of all, just as a mecca where all the best high school talent from around the country ended up there at some point. And then also just the physical circumstances of Five-Star. You think about being outside on the converted tennis courts and the hot sun and walking up and down the hills at Robert Morris and just the accommodations. And then you think about the guys that were there. We're talking about the top players in the history of the game that all went through there. Right. And now you think about how kids go through on the AAU circuit and playing in air conditioned gyms and everything's on the wood floor and with officials and coaches and people in the stands and all that stuff. And it's just, it's one of those things that when you try to explain it to somebody in today's basketball world who wasn't around for that Five-Star era, they have a really hard time wrapping their head around what Five-Star was.
Yeah. You know, there just wasn't a way to get your name out there and to get noticed unless you were at, you know, a big, you know, single or triple A high school at the time in the state of Ohio, you know, unless you played at a Canton McKinley or, you know, a Solon or, you know, a Toledo St. Francis, you know, those types of schools, then sure, you were going to get noticed. But, you know, coming from a smaller high school, you know, I had to find a way to kind of to get out there and compete against some guys who were awfully, you know, some pretty good players. And going to Five-Star was kind of my vehicle to do it. And, you know, like I said, that first year I kind of survived. I learned a lot about what I wasn't and the things that I needed to become. And, you know, that second year I went back and I did back-to-back weeks. And I remember my dad came out, you know, like on Thursday or whatever day camp ended the first week and we spent the night at the hotel and, you know, and he just kind of talked to me about whether or not he was wasting his money. And I promised him he wasn't. And, you know, I had a really good week the next week. And that helped a lot. And it was brutal. Let's just call it what it was. But, you know, being outside 90 degree heat, you know, all day long. And then they used to have station 13, which was, you know, the optional station. And I remember distinctly that first week, I didn't miss a single Station 13. And they used to, you know, reward the players at the end of the week who never missed one. And they never mentioned me. And I was broken. I was like, you got to be kidding me.
And, like I was out there in the heat every day.
Absolutely. I found, you know, my coach from the week starting the following week. And I kind of told him, I said, listen, I said, I didn't miss a single Station 13 last week. And I'm not going to miss one this week. I said, but, you know, you need to let the powers to be know that I was around and I'm here and I'm trying to do something. And, you know, sure enough, at the end of the second week, the squeaky wheel got the grease, you know, and they threw me a little recognition. But, you know, it was 5-star changed my life. I mean, you could say what you want about it. There are a lot of people who didn't like it. You know, there were a lot of things about it I didn't necessarily care for. But it gave me the opportunity to go play basketball in college. And, you know, that was my dream and that's what I wanted. And, you know, fortunately that was a big part of me getting there.
Do you remember any of the guys that were there big names, the guys that were there while you were playing?
Yeah. I mean, my senior year, I actually played on a camp team with Jeff Lebo and, you know, Jeff was just a fantastic player and Danny Ferry was there that week, you know, and Danny was like the biggest name in the group. You know, outside of those two guys, you know, Alonzo Mourning was there. He was a little bit younger. You know, there were so many good guys. And honestly, you know, going through, you know, 5 weeks in the course of a 3 year period, you see a lot of guys come and go. And unfortunately, I'm getting a little older. But I remember Jeff being there and I remember Danny being there and remember what it was like to be on the floor with those guys the first time. It's a little awestruck at first. And then you got to figure out where you fit in. So.
Yeah, you hear those names, and the week I was there, and I only went the summer before my senior year, and I got in through a friend, and we ended up going and playing that first night. And I remember I didn't make the top league that my week I was there, so I was in whatever I can't remember what the distinctions were or whatever, but I was in the league below, and the big name I was there the week I was there was Billy Owens, and at that time. At that time, I knew every high school player across the country. You know, I mean, I was studying my Blue Ribbon College Basketball Yearbook, right. And I knew all the college players and this and that. And so, you know, you kind of know some of these names. And then you get there and looking forward to being able to have an opportunity to play at that higher level, maybe get a chance to get out on the court with somebody like Billy Owens. Then, you know, when you get relegated, you're like, oh, you know. But I ended up coming back and getting the MVP of the All-Star game in that lower division. But still – it's just one of those things where you look back on it and you're like, man, we played on asphalt, which, yeah. I mean, I'm sure I'm speaking for you too. I spent so much time. If I think about the amount of time that I spent out on asphalt courts, you know, in my community, just playing where guys would drive in and just play pickup basketball. And then you combine that with five-star and all that stuff. And then you think about the way that the kids that you're coaching and the kids that are coming up in this current system, the way that they play, it's just a totally, totally different world. And I always feel like, I mean, I guess I'm partial to the way that you and I came up in the game and the ability to go out and play with guys from different places and different ages and without officials and without mom and dad sitting in the stands. And sure. I think there's just a different thing that you learn about the game. And that's not to say that there aren't benefits to the current system, because certainly there are. But I think kids miss out on, and they don't even know what they're missing out on, that playground basketball culture is something that I'm sad to see disappear.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, we talk about it with our kids all the time. You know, when things are good, our kids are willing to compete. And, you know, that being down and being able to fight back, that's something that I feel like we're losing. And a lot of that comes from just, you know, I think that, you know, you go back to being at the second level at 5-star, the first thing 5-star ever did to me was humble me. You know, I went there as a sophomore and, you know, I averaged 17 or 18 points a game on a pretty good high school basketball team. And, you know, same situation. I got humbled right away and I found out all the things that I was not. And, you know, something to be said for that. And, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, grinding it out outside. Is something to be said for playing pickup games where if you lose, you're not going to play for 35, 40 minutes. You know, that's kind of where that competitive desire and that competitive nature kind of gets built. And I think we're skipping over that part these days, you know, with the way AAU is. You know, we kind of talked a little bit as a staff last week about, you know, just watching a high school basketball game. And if, you know, if you didn't stay to the end and you didn't know who won, but you walked back in the gym 10 minutes later and you looked at the 30 kids coming out of the two locker rooms, it's hard to tell who won and who lost anymore.
That's so true.
You know, because I think a lot of it is, and, you know, don't get me wrong. I'm not an AAU basher. I don't necessarily always see the purpose for it, especially at the high school level. But these kids are so used to, well, that's okay. We lost. We got another game in 35 minutes, you know, one of those types of things. And I don't know, maybe I was just too much of a baby as a young player. I always tended to want to dwell on that a little bit. And, you know, there was a reason why losing felt different than winning.
I agree with you. I think that that was one of the biggest adjustments that I had to make when I got into coaching, was to sort of be able to accept the fact that not every kid took losses as hard as I took them and didn't process them in the same way. And I think that you're right in that the culture of today's basketball is, so what, we lost this one. There's another game coming in 2 hours. And if we lose that one, there's another tournament coming next weekend. And I know I'm going to get to keep playing because my mom paid $600 for me to be on this team. And so I get to keep playing. Whereas you and I both know the playground hierarchy is a lot different than that. If you're not going to help somebody win a game and there's four teams deep sitting on the side, guess what? Nobody's picking you up.
And, yeah, you're of no use to them.
And so, you know, you find that out real quick. I know when I was, you know, when I first started playing at our playground here, and I would show up and I was probably, I don't know, 13, 14 years old. And I would make sure I was the first guy there because I knew I could get in the first game.
Right.
And I'd stay until the very end because I knew I could get in the last game. And any games I got in between that were a bonus. And I might have been sitting there for, you know, an hour, hour and a half waiting my turn until somebody vouched for the skinny little 13-year-old kid to get in there. Like, hey, man, let's get this kid in the game. Yeah. And then eventually you kind of earn your place and you figure it out. And I think that, you know, kids today, it just sometimes, as you said, that competitiveness of, man, I got to do whatever it takes to get better because I want to be out on the court, whether that's out on the court on the playground side of it or now the way you're looking at it from, you know, a kid that's going to compete who maybe, you know, he's looking for a bigger opportunity with his high school team. And man, you got to get out there and you got to compete and it's got to mean something to you. And I think that, you know, you hit the nail on the head there with making sure that you look at what kids are doing when they come out of the locker room. It's really, really interesting to see how they process winning and losing. And again, I don't necessarily know that the way that I might have handled it was completely 100% healthy. I know I've got a picture of two of me sitting against the bleachers, you know, with tears or, you know, a scowl on my face. And I'm not sure that's necessarily the healthiest way to handle it either. But I think there's a happy medium. And I think it has to burn inside of you, that desire to be better and that desire to win. And I think that, you know, again, that's still out there. There's still kids who have that. But I think the playground basketball culture really made you desire winning as opposed to just being like, eh, whatever, I'm moving on to the next game. It just didn't work that way.
Right. Well, I think you develop that want, you know, and if you truly want something and, you know, it's attainable, but there's a certain amount of work that has to be involved to get it, you know, whether it's showing up an hour early or staying an hour late, you know, what is it going to be? I just think especially, you know, in today's society, I just see a lot of, you know, things get a little bit tough and it's easy to turn our back and go the opposite direction and go do something else. And that scares me, especially in high school athletics. You know, you're seeing participation numbers down at a lot of your smaller schools. You know, my old high school, unfortunately, doesn't have a junior or a senior class of high school basketball players.
Wow.
You know, they're playing with only freshmen and sophomore because all those kids have left the program. And, you know, for whatever reason, you know, you can blame it on a lot of things. I just think it's just too easy for kids to say no and just go do something else anymore. And that scares me. You know, life throws a lot of obstacles at you. And unfortunately, you know, every once in a while, you got to kind of stand up and face it and deal with it to try to move your way through it instead of just running away from things. And I don't know. It's maybe I'm just getting too old. Everything seems too new and easy these days. But that's just me.
Yeah, but I think as a coach and an educator, I think what you're looking at and what you see is you're looking at not only what is right in front of you in the moment, but I think you're looking out ahead and saying, that you know what, and this is how I always look at it, and I think you're probably looking at it the same way, is that you know how important sports were to you and to the person that you eventually became and the lessons that you learned through everything that you did. And again, not all those lessons were easy or simple or ones that you enjoyed in the moment, but they're lessons that you take in your regular life today as a teacher, as a coach, and you have become a better person as a result of being a participant in team sports. And I think as we look at the landscape of where kids are, and, you know, I think it goes to another point of kids getting burned out so early that, you know, here you are talking about no junior and senior class at a high school. The kids are all, nobody's playing basketball. Right. And you wonder, was that a kid that was playing 12 months of the year when they were 8 years old? And by the time they're 14, they're like, you know, I liked basketball, but I never loved it. And now right. I'm already done with it. I'm out. And I think that's a danger too.
I couldn't agree more. You know, it's, I just think, yeah, I just see so many things going on right now that, you know, just are a little bit scary, you know, with the direction of things. And, you know, and don't get me wrong, I see a lot of great things every day too. I really do. It's just, I guess as a bit of a perfectionist as a coach, you know, you tend to focus more on the negative and not as much on the positive, but, I don't know. Sometimes it's easy to recognize that, and sometimes it's not.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm going to ask you this question, which I don't ask everybody, but I think it's a relevant one here. If you had to say you love winning or hate losing, which one? if you had to pick only one, which one would you pick?
I pick them both, of course. I love winning. I do. But I don't think it even compares to my general disdain for losing. I just can't stomach it. You know, I remember being a kid, and it was one of my first memories, and I think it was a baseball game, you know, and we had gone out and just played terrible and got beat by a team that had no business beating us. And, you know, it was one of those rides on the car, you know, on the car ride home where nobody said anything. And, you know, we got home, and, you know, my dad just kind of turned and looked into the back seat, and he says, "How's that feel?" And I just kind of looked at him. I ain't saying nothing. I was pretty smart. I knew better than to say anything. But it always just kind of stuck with me because, you know, to him, losing had a feeling too, you know. I didn't pick up all these bad habits on my own. I can give some to my dad. But I'll never forget it. It stuck with me forever.
Yeah, I agree with you that losing is 10 times worse than how good winning feels. And when I look back at my playing career and my coaching career, the games that stand out far and away are the games that we lost.
Right.
And I think that those are the ones that stick with you. Those are the ones that burn. Those are the ones that you wish you had back. Those are the ones that you wish you were waking up on the morning of that game so you could replay it. And I just think that losing, that feeling that you just described, that your dad passed along to you and that you felt, I think that's something that for people who are competitive, I think that's what drives you. That feeling of wanting to avoid losing at all costs, I think is what drives you. Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I was afraid of losing. I can say that. I'm still afraid of losing, you know. I guess that's, you know, that was kind of where I found a lot of my motivation, you know, along the way. I think it's where I find some of my motivation now. You know, when we started at Woodridge 7 years ago, we weren't very good. And, you know, it was tough to win. And we appreciated those wins. But we were looking forward to, you know, a day when they weren't quite as frequent. And, you know, now that we're there, it's a totally different type of stress that lays over you because, you know, now it's, you know, that I've got to prepare. I can't drop the ball on this. You know, we can't lose to this team. We're better than they are. One of those types of things. And, you know, that fear of losing is a pretty solid motivator in my world.
Yeah. It's palpable. I think all the time when you're coaching, when you're playing and you know, you're not getting a second opportunity when that game is gone and it's lost and you just feel like, oh, you can't go back and fix that. And I think that, like I said, that that drives people who are competitive, I think, more than anything. And I always find the answer to that question interesting. And almost everybody that I've asked it to who describes himself as competitive, almost to a person, they say, I hate losing, as opposed to I love winning. And I just think that it makes, from my end of it, it makes complete sense. So let's go back to your college recruitment days and talk a little bit about how you ended up going to Rhode Island. Talk a little bit about what the recruiting process was like for you back then and just how you ended up there. And then we'll eventually get you to Kent in a little bit.
Yeah. You know, coming out of my junior year, I had some interest, local schools, you know, a few MAC schools, Youngstown State, went to five-star, had a really good week. And Brendan Malone was, you know, way up on the hierarchy at the time at five-star, and probably the beginning of June was named the new head coach at Rhode Island. And, you know, coming into that summer, he was a little behind on recruiting. So he hit five-star really hard. And I was one of the guys that they went after. And I'd say once we got to September, I had it narrowed down to, you know, probably three schools. And Marquette was at the top of my list. And Rick Majerus was there. And, you know, as happens, I wasn't their number one guy at the small forward position. And when the number one said yes, it, you know, that dropped me. They didn't have a scholarship for me. So it was kind of between Pitt and Rhode Island, and I was Rhode Island's number one. I wasn't necessarily Pitt's, and I kind of, you know, I put my eggs in Brendan Malone's basket and went out there my freshman year. And, you know, we didn't have a lot of success, you know, new staff, a lot of new players, had some transfers, didn't have, you know, anywhere near the success he was expecting, I don't think. And, a job that summer came up with the Knicks organization and Hubie Brown, who had, you know, who had worked with Brendan for a number of years, and Brendan jumped at it. He was there 1 year and gone. And Tom Penders came in, and Tom Penders, you know, nothing against Brendan Malone. I love the man. He was fantastic to me. Tom Penders came in and took exactly the same roster and turned us from 9-22 to 20-11. But he was completely different. He was a different mindset. He was positive every single day. He took some guys and just found things in them that they didn't even know they were capable of. And it was a lot of fun experience of both styles of coaching. That kind of put an end to my sophomore year. Was, you know, my last year at Rhode Island, and my dad wasn't well, and I was having a hard time being that far away from home with everything that was going on. And I kind of went to Coach Penders, and we had a long conversation about it. And I asked him for his help in finding me a new home. And he was very gracious. And I gave him a list of three schools that I was interested in, and Kent being one of them. And he was courteous enough to me to call Jim McDonald, and ended up making a visit there as soon as I got back after spring semester. And that was kind of it. I never visited the other two. Just became a Kent guy.
There you go. The rest is history.
It was a great move for all involved. It was very hard the year that I redshirted, and, you know, because you transferred, you had to sit.
For sure.
And, you know, Rhode Island won 26 games that year and made it to, I believe, the Elite Eight. They beat Ronnie Cicely and Syracuse. Yep. You know, those were my boys. I was a part of that team. I can't say that I was an integral part of that team. You know, I was a guy who might play 6 minutes one night, 8 minutes the next. But it was hard sitting there watching those guys have a lot of success. But I was happy for them.
So talk a little bit about how difficult it was to go through a season of practice without the carrot being dangled in front of you of having an opportunity to play. Because obviously there's a lot of kids out there. All you got to do is look at the NCAA transfer portal and know that, you know, there's lots of guys that go to one school and end up leaving and going somewhere else and are kind of in that same situation that you were in back then, where you got to sit and not play for an entire year. So talk a little bit about what that was like, because I can only imagine.
It was brutal. That's just the best word for it. I don't think it, you know, my first 2 years in college, you know, like I said, I was hit and miss. I played a little some nights, and there were some nights where I didn't play, and that was always difficult. But to know that you didn't have an opportunity, you know, if you don't play on Tuesday night, that's one thing. But you got a chance to go back in the gym on Wednesday and hey, you know what? I'm going to be the hardest working SOB for the next 2 hours, and I'm going to make them play me. You know, when you're sitting out, that doesn't even exist. It's just get up, go to practice, get beat on a little bit more. You know, try not to get injured. try to do what the coaches are saying. You know, try not to draw any attention to yourself. You know, Mac was always huge on that. But it was not an easy thing. And, you know, I think the hardest part was, you know, we weren't having a lot of success as a team either. And you know how that is, you know,
yep.
January and February turn into a complete grind if there's not good things happening on game nights. And, you know, we were struggling in the conference, and it's hard to have the guys go, you know, 6 hours up to Central Michigan, get beat by 30, come back, and, you know, we're back on the floor the next day at 2 o'clock, and the coaches are mad, the players are mad, you know, and all I'm doing is sitting there going, man, I didn't even have a hand in this.
I had nothing to do with it. Come on.
And, you know, that was tough. But, you know, once again, you know, just like everything else, you know, where are you going to find your motivation? And, you know, it got me to, you know, through that season, you know, into that next summer, was probably the hardest I had worked in my life. I thought that, you know, coming into my junior year at Kent, I was as well prepared as I needed to be a college basketball player. And, you know, fortunately, you know, we had a pretty good group of guys that year, and, you know, we were able to win some games early and get some confidence, and, turned it into a really nice 2-year run. You know, the 2 years that I was there, you know, just, a lot of guys put forth a heck of a lot of effort and a little bit of good fortune along the way, and we were able to win some games. So, made it. My experience with Kent was fantastic. I wouldn't change it for the world. But yeah, that first year was not any fun.
So, from your junior year, my freshman year, what do you remember about the MAC final against Ball State, where we lost by one, man, coming up 1 point away from making the tournament? I know
got to bring that up.
What I remember but from being a freshman is, you know, and not having the perspective at that time, you're like, oh man, you know, that stinks, but I think we're gonna get back there. And, you know, again, I was in the same situation where I played a little bit, but right, didn't play a whole lot that first year. And so you're looking at it going, yeah, you know, next year when I'm playing, we're gonna get another opportunity to do that. And of right, course, obviously, you know, didn't come to pass. But just tell me a little bit about what you remember about that MAC tournament.
Man, they just wanted us to beat them. That's how they played the entire game. You know, amazingly, the most selfish thing in the world I remember about is I scored 6 points in the first 5 minutes of the game and never scored again. And it eats at me. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there were opportunities. I played a ton of minutes that game. And I'm not saying that I wasn't able to impact the game in other ways. But that just eats at me, because I did not play anywhere near as well as I thought I was capable of playing. And, you know, anytime you lose a game that close to a team that was, I mean, let's be honest, when we went to Ball State that year, they beat us by 25. They just thumped us, you know, and we had to have a lot of things go our way to beat them at our place, you know, along with 6,000 fans losing their minds.
That was an awesome,
it was a great, great those, environment. Great
those atmosphere. Environments. The Ball State environments those first 2 years,
yeah,
just were it was incredible. Yeah, it was incredible. Yes.
And then, you know, to go up to Toledo and play, you know, it's not anywhere close to that environment. But you know, like I said, I kind of felt like the entire game we just kind of they wanted us to beat them. You know, they were just doing enough to keep us around. And you know, Eric played a whale of a game that night, and I wish I would have played better, because, like you, I walked out of there feeling like, you know what, it's all right. We'll be back next year. We'll make another run at this thing. And, you know, looking back 30 years later, I'm going, wow, man, I needed to play a little bit better that night, because that was our opportunity to play in the NCAA tournament. And that was, you know, one of those dreams, much like, you know, as a high school kid wanted to play in the Final Four down to St. John's. Once it's gone, it's gone. You don't get a do-over. So I have a lot of regrets. I thought that, you know, I thought we had a chance there, and I mean, we definitely had a chance. I thought we should have won the basketball game, and I wish I'd have been a little better.
I agree. I mean, I agree that you look back on that opportunity and you think, God, one point, it's one play. Sure. here or there that makes the difference that sends you to, again, what would have been an experience of a lifetime, something that you grew up dreaming about, something that I grew up dreaming about, and just the opportunity to suit up in the NCAA tournament would have been tremendous, and to miss out on it. And then, as you said, I think that, you know, you still felt like, oh, we still got, you know, I still had three more years. You still had one more. Right. And, you know, from my perspective, especially having not played as much and not, as you described with yourself at Rhode Island, being, there's a difference between being an integral part of the team and not being an integral part of the team. And just sort of in the feeling that you have. And so, you know, I looked at it as, all right, next year, you know, there's going to hopefully be an opportunity for me to play, and, you know, we're going to be right back. We got, you know, we got all our guys back, and we're going to be, you know, we're going to be right there again. And we were, you know, yeah. you look at our regular season, your senior year. And, you know, I think we, you know, we played very, very well all throughout the entire year. I think didn't we win two in-season tournaments that year?
Yeah.
So did. I think we won, we won at UAB maybe.
We did win at UAB. I think might have played at Boise State that year. I think we split at Boise, but we won at UAB at the beginning of the year.
And, you know, it was just that group was just a fun group, and we had everybody kind of – the way I remember that team is everybody that played was almost in the perfect role for them. In that moment on that team, it just felt like the group came together, you know, really, really well. And, you know, we were heading into the tournament thinking, all right, we can, you know, we get another shot at Ball State, who had another tremendous year. And, you know, and then we just, you know, we just came up short in that first game. Just played probably our worst game of the season.
Oh, by far.
You know, collectively. And it was so disappointing to not make another MAC tournament run. And, you know, just as you said, like, you can't, you know, you try to go back and think, what could we have done differently, man, if only it would have turned out, and we would have wanted another shot at Ball State. And you know, for whatever reason, it wasn't meant to be. But that was a fun year. And that, for me, that was my last year of winning basketball, because the next 2 years we struggled. So it was, like I said, I think what you said about, you know, your experience at Kent, and, you know, people always ask me about my experience, and, you know, there were obviously some tough things that went on there, and Coach McDonald and all of us didn't necessarily always see eye to eye, but I always tell people that I was the type of player that he liked. And as a result of that, I got an opportunity to play college basketball, where I think if you would have looked back at me heading into college or at the end of my senior year, I was a borderline Division I player in most people's eyes. And it turned out to be the perfect place for me, because I got an opportunity for somebody who respected the things that I did well. And as a result, that got me out on the floor. And I think that, you know, the same thing probably can be said from your point of view as well.
Oh, absolutely. I guess I've grown to appreciate Coach McDonald more the older I get. As a 22-year-old, I didn't always agree with everything he did. But I will tell you that I was 100 times better player at Kent than I was ever going to be at Rhode Island. I had already kind of made that first impression. They knew what my limitations were, and, you know, I was going to be kind of held to those. I had the opportunity at Kent to come in and, you know, make a different first impression. And was able to do some other things. And Kent was a perfect fit for me. I wish I would have spent all 4 years there. But, you know, like I said, the Rhode Island experience helped shape me into the player I was when, you know, when I finally got on the floor as a junior at Kent. I still find myself, you know, using Jim McDonald-isms every once in a while.
Is it a lead pipe cinch down there at Woodbridge?
Yeah, you know, don't fight City Hall, one of those days. Yeah. I get to see Jay Peters quite a bit on a regular basis, and we always kind of joke a little bit about it. But I think that, you know, if you ask Jay, and he'd say the same thing that I will right now, I have a lot of respect for what he did. We had a lot of success, and he was a big part of that. And, you know, much like yourself, the opportunity to play Division I basketball is not something that gets afforded every kid. And I'm very thankful for the things that happened to me.
Absolutely. All right. What's your favorite Coach McDonald story?
Oh, man. All right. So it's part of the redshirt year.
Okay.
And it's a bad day in practice. And I'm stuck guarding Barnwell, who I didn't get along with very well at the time. We end up being, you know, pretty good friends by the time we're seniors. But at this point, I don't get along with him. I don't like him. And we had just played about 14 straight possessions on defense. And for six out of the 14 possessions, he catches the ball in the post and hits me with an elbow somewhere. Well, he finally catches me in the jaw. And I tackle him to the ground. And somehow I end up running the stairs for the next hour while Dave Barnwell continues practicing. And I was not happy about it. But that was probably my favorite Coach McDonald story. He just kind of looked at me and pointed at the stairs and away I went. So it was
no questions asked, right?
Heck of a day. Yeah. What do you say, right? What am I going to say?
Exactly.
I'm not going to say anything. This is it for me. I got to make it work here. It ain't going to work anywhere.
That's right. You got to keep my mouth closed
and get to running.
Yep. I think my favorite one is when Eric Stuhl got smashed in the locker room, and then the next day we came into the locker room and he was just sitting on the the seat portion, and the legs were gone. That was probably my favorite, because it honestly, when you think back on that now, like it took a lot of guts for Eric to sit there on the platform of that school without any legs. And then it ended up turned out that everybody, including Coach McDonald, got a big chuckle out of it.
Someone laughed about it.
He did, which was rare.
Yeah,
it was rare. But I think that was – I'm not so sure if that had been my stool that I would have been willing to sit there on it.
You had to be Eric Glenn. You had to be a four-year starter. You had to be a 4-0 student. You know, you had to be all the things that Eric Glenn was. And thank God it was his stool that got broken.
Absolutely. That was a classic one that I always enjoy the retelling of him just sitting there on the ground on his little his little platform seat without the legs of the stool. That was a classic. That was a classic.
Head Start Basketball, along with members of the Jay Billis Skills Camp staff, will be hosting the very first Prime Skills Camp, an affiliate of the Jay Billis Skills Camp that is held annually in Charlotte, North Carolina. Prime Skills Camp will take place on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, June 26th through the 28th, and will be designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9. Prime Skills Camp will mirror the Jay Billis Skills Camp in daily programming, teaching, coach-to-camper ratio, and quality of instruction. Prime Skills Camp brings all of the team-oriented individual instruction, focus on the fundamentals, and high-level coaching to young men aspiring to a high school varsity basketball experience. This camp is operated by Billis Camp veterans and includes the Jay Billis Coaches Development Program alongside the camp, ensuring that the quality of teaching and coaching at this camp is second to none. Please visit headstartbasketball.com or jaybilliscamp.com for more information or to get registered.
All right, so let's transition and start talking a little coaching. When did you have in mind that you wanted to coach? Was it something that you always had in the back of your head from the time you were a kid? Was it something that came to you while you were in school? Was it something that you're like, hey, I want to teach and maybe I'll coach? Or was it always a passion of yours? Just tell us a little bit about the genesis of your coaching career and where it started.
You know, I was in college already. I think it was my sophomore year at Rhode Island. And I'll preface by saying coaches talk all the time about this kid here, he's going to be a future coach someday. You know, I heard it said about so many people over the years. And I can honestly say that nobody ever said it about. But my sophomore year, I was an accounting major and I was struggling in the classroom. I couldn't find any meaning of what I was kind of sat down with a counselor, and you know, and he was like, well, what would you like to do? And I know what I'm doing, like, I don't like. And we kind of went through some things and I kind of jumped at the teaching thing. And, you know, my freshman year in college, I had already gone back to 5-star and worked as a counselor for a couple of weeks and kind of got to the thinking, you know, that maybe someday I'll want to coach. Well, if I teach, then, you know, I can get my summers off. I can wear sweatpants every day and maybe I'll coach longer. And to be honest with you, when I graduated, I wasn't really thinking about coaching. I had a couple opportunities to GA, and that wasn't really what I was looking to do. Just kind of wanted to be done with the whole thing. And just kind of out of the blue, I backed into a teaching job. Dave Grube's college roommate was the athletic director at Cuyahoga Falls, which kind of led me to a teaching job. And I volunteered on the staff that year and had a really good year. And just kind of worked my way into his JV position, I believe, year three. Was a JV coach there for probably 4 or 5 years and kind of stepped away for a couple years, just kind of got out of it. I was just kind of burnt out and went back as Rob Sloan's assistant back in, I think, 2002, 2003, right in that area, and was with him for 10 years. So I don't know. I can't say that I was ever as passionate about being a coach as I was about being a player, but I know that I love the game and, you know, this was a way to stay close to it.
Yeah, your story is very similar to mine. I look back on my time as a player, and I'm not sure that I ever really had in mind that I would coach. It never really, to be honest with you, crossed my mind because I always thought of myself as a player. And so the idea of me stopping playing seemed completely foreign.
Sure.
And then thinking about, okay, am I going to coach? It never really crossed my mind until I was there. And so I always find it interesting. I think that the stories are either ones like yours where it wasn't something that you grew up dreaming about. And then you have other people who, you know, are talking about, I was in second grade and I would draw plays on, you know, the back of my placemat and all this different stuff. And I definitely wasn't that kid. I was definitely much more focused on playing. And so when you had that first opportunity to join a coaching staff, what do you remember about the first time when you're kind of coaching a team as opposed to, you know, you're at Five Star, you're coaching in a camp environment, a little different to be a member of a high school staff? And
yeah,
talk a little bit about what that was like, your first experience and what you remember from those early years or year of coaching.
I remember, you know, this is quite a few years ago, but, you know, I was at a very good high school basketball program and having the opportunity to coach the JVs, you know, I ran across a number of pretty good basketball players who were fighting to kind of make that next step. And I remember, you know, kind of looking back on it after, you know, 4 years of coaching JV basketball and kind of coming to the realization that I didn't really even understand what my purpose was as a coach. You know, I was so concerned with winning and losing that I did not probably do as good a job as I should have done preparing these kids to be varsity basketball players. But a lot of that was, you know, just immaturity, only being in my 20s and not really having a solid of understanding. You know, the only coaching acumen I ever had was, you know, what I had been around.
Right.
You know, which so was true. Maybe four meaningful coaches over a 12-year period. And, you know, what necessarily worked for them would not necessarily work for me, but I didn't realize that. I guess I just kind of, you know, marched the way they had marched and hoped that everything would, you know, all the winnings would just follow with it. And, you know, it didn't. I had to kind of find my own style and, you know, my own way of doing things. And I took a lot of it from the things that, you know, as a player, I enjoyed and the things that I didn't. And, you know, I tell my guys all the time, you know, I know what's terrible about practice. I know what parts are terrible, but I also know what parts are necessary. And, you know, we kind of have to do some of those too. And, you know, it's when I tell them that, you know, like, hey, this, I understand it's not enjoyable. They should believe me because I do. But, you know, that's part of kind of learning your way. And, you know, fortunately for me, I've been able to stay in the game as long as I have. I was also very fortunate not to be a head coach until I turned, you know, 45, 46 years old. I think if I'd have been a head coach in my 20s, I don't think I would have lasted into my mid-30s. I just don't. I think the, you know, the lack of experience and the lack of success would have drove me out of it. I think, you know, now that I'm a little more mature, I can handle a little bit of both. I may not handle it well, but I can handle it. And, you know, it's allowed me to stay in the game a little longer than it probably I even thought it would.
So when you were a young coach, did you find that you were completely reliant upon, I guess, your own knowledge of the game from being a player and the coaches that you had been around? Because that's what I felt like. I felt like, you know, I knew how to play. I know what I'm doing. And I look back on it now and I realize that I should have been going to clinics. I should have been reaching out to coaching mentors as opposed to just kind of being my own little self island of things. And my first experience too, Rick, was coaching a JV team. And I remember the thing that I remember most vividly was I walked into the gym the first day of practice and I had 12 JV basketball players staring at me. And we started practice. And after like 5 minutes, I'm like, there is like 5,000 things going wrong in this first 5 minutes. How am I ever going to fix all this? Like, it was just, it was completely overwhelming. And I was one set of eyes. And so obviously coming out of a college environment where you have multiple coaches and you have one person who's looking at the defense, another person who's looking at the offense, and you got other people that are there to keep score and to track the time and all this stuff. And now I'm just one guy trying to do all that. And I remember being just completely overwhelmed from that standpoint. And yet for some reason, still, it didn't dawn on me to go out and seek more help. And the staff that I worked on my first year, I was at Bay Village. So I had Rich Voyers, who was a legendary coach in the state of Ohio, who coached Billy Tool and, you know, had just tremendous teams there. But Rich was toward the end of his career. He was probably, I would guess he was probably getting up close to 70 years old by the time, you know, I was there. And so I was a 23-year-old kid. And then the assistant coach, Dick Scott, was also, he was probably in his 50s at that point. And so there was a disconnect between us, not in a bad way, but just they weren't necessarily guys that I would have gone to and asked some of the questions that I probably should have been asking. And, you know, I look back on that time and I think that's one of my biggest regrets in terms of my coaching career, is that I think if I would have spent more time reaching out to other coaches and reading and doing things and not just kind of relying on my own knowledge, I think I would have probably had, I would have been a better coach for the players that were in front of me. And I think, just like you said, I think if I had been given an opportunity to be a head coach at that young age, I don't know how successful I would have been, because I probably would have continued to think that I can figure this thing out. And eventually, let's put it this way, the older I get, the more I realize that I know next to nothing about about being a good coach. I think there's so much there's so much out there that we can continue to learn. And I think you said it best when you talked about finding your coaching purpose. And when I was young, just like you, I wanted to win and nothing else really mattered. I wasn't concerned about anything really beyond that. And now you look at it and you say, man, you have such an opportunity to impact kids in so many different ways besides on the scoreboard. And I just don't think I realized that when I was younger.
Yeah, I agree. And I, you know, to be honest, with at least in my situation, a lot of it was just plain arrogance. You know, I thought, you know, hey, I'm a former Division I basketball player. Right. I know what's going on. I don't need help. I don't need, you know, what's this guy going to tell me? You know, one of those things. And, you know, I've got a couple of younger guys on my staff now, and I love the fact that, you know, they're constantly, you know, sending me plays that they see, you know, stuff that they're writing down, whether watching a game or seeing something, you know, that comes across in an email from coach's clipboard or something. You know, they're just kind of, they're trying to absorb everything. And I think to myself, man, I've never been like that. And I think it's just, you know, you were kind of talking about there's certain guys that just have a passion to coach, and, you know, getting into it the way I did, I don't know that my passion was ever coaching, you know, but it was definitely a way to stay involved in the game. And, you know, for everybody, there comes a time when you can't play it anymore. But if you still want to be involved, you know, coaching can become your avenue, or you can become a referee. I don't know why anybody right now would do that.
I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, you know, it's,
thank God there are people that want to do it, because I certainly don't.
Tell me about it. And we need more of them. I feel for those guys. You know, it's, I try to be as easy on them as I can. I'm probably not real good at it most of the time, but I think we have a lot of great officials in our area, and you know, that's a totally different conversation.
Man, that is a tough job, and
it's a tough racket. You're only going to make half the people right at any one time.
No question about that. I think one of the things that struck me about what you just said with your young coaches is, I do think that in today's world, it's so much easier to go out and find knowledge, find information. There's so many more resources that you can go to as a young coach. And then I also think that the message is out there for coaches that, hey, if you want to be good at this, you've got to go out and you've got to seek information. You've got to seek mentors. You got to go to clinics. You got to do some of these things to help build up your knowledge base. And then to go along with that, you also have the message out there of having a greater impact on the kids that are in front of you beyond just teaching them basketball skills. And how can you impact their life? And I think when we were coming up as players and then early in our coaching career, not that that wasn't a factor, but I think in a lot of cases, it wasn't nearly as prevalent as it is today. And I think there are coaches and the coaching profession has come to the realization that that stuff is equally important. And in a lot of cases, if you do it well, it can also have a positive impact on your one loss record if you do it right and build those relationships with kids and help them develop as people in addition to good basketball players.
Yeah. You know, it comes down to effort. You know, whether you're a coach or a player, you're going to be rewarded for effort. And, you know, maybe it's a little bit easier, but you know, you still got to put the time in. And, you know, there's still guys out there that, you know, and I see them, you know, who still go out and, you know, personally scout games and then watch, you know, hours and hours of tape on top of that. It's just effort, you know, how much work do you want to put in, and, you know, how important is it to be good to you?
Yeah. So true. So true. Let me follow up on that. I'm going to ask you a question about being an assistant, but I want to follow up on what you just said. So talk to me a little bit about the challenges of being a high school basketball coach in the year 2020. What are some of the things that on a day-to-day basis, a season-to-season basis, that you find to be the most challenging in your job there at Woodridge?
I think in 2020, you know, the biggest difference is just the time commitment. And I'm not talking from just a strictly coaching standpoint. I'm talking, you know, June, I'm talking July, I'm talking, you know, weight training in the fall, open gyms in the spring. You know, we do so much more now. And I'm a big proponent of the multi-sport kid, but trying to get these kids to balance their schedule so that, you know, you can go to three or four shootouts, you know, trying to get them to show up at individual training stuff. You know, those are the things that you used to be able to do to get ahead. Now you've got
the baseline
things just to tread water.
Yep, I agree.
And it's getting tougher and tougher. And, you know, I've got some great young kids in my program. God bless them. You know, they ring my phone every Sunday morning. So on my one God-given day off, I'm still in the gym for a couple hours with those guys because I don't want to tell them no.
Right.
But just, you know, the amount of time that not only we as coaches, but our players, we expect our players to put this time in, and it's tougher and tougher. And, you know, basketball's become a 10-month a year sport. Because basically, you know, with the state giving us two dead periods, you know, that's the only time I can ever say, hey, you know what? No, we can't do anything today because I'm on my dead period. It's tough, you know, and, you know, our football coach is trying to balance the same thing. Our baseball coach is trying to balance the same thing, you know, along with, you know, I've got a number of baseball kids in my program, and we have a very good baseball program at our high school. And, you know, those kids do a lot in the summer with baseball, and to try to get them to balance and do a little bit with basketball, it's a bear. And, you know, just to do all that to tread water, just the juice doesn't, the juice is not worth the squeeze as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. I think that's one of the things that I hear universally from guys, girls who have come on the podcast to talk about their programs is just the amount of time that is required of a high school coach in 2020 compared to what was required 30 years ago. And it goes back to the top of our conversation with the playground basketball culture has disappeared. So your kids aren't getting better by going up to the local park and playing with guys up there. They need to have a gym open so they can get in and get workouts in and get some run up and down the floor. And that used to be something that, sure, a high school coach might occasionally have an open gym in the summertime, but, you know, you're in the gym every single day when it's not a dead period, I'm sure. And those are things that people out there who aren't familiar with what it takes to be a high school basketball coach, whether it be, you know, the parent of a fifth or sixth grader, a kid who still hasn't kind of got into the scholastic basketball system and is just sitting in the stands on a Friday night watching a high school game. I don't think that those people have a complete understanding of what that looks like. And I think you made another great point too about the commitment that we ask today of a high school basketball player.
Mm-hmm.
And then put that one step further, the things that we ask of their families. And I know, like, I have three kids, and to try to get them to the different places that they have to be with different sports and this and that, and having everybody there, it's a challenge. And it's a challenge from a coaching standpoint. It's a challenge from a kid standpoint. It's a challenge from a parent standpoint. And eventually, you know, you just you run out of time. There's only so much time. There's only so much time in your day. And I think you hit it right on the head, that that challenge of how do I balance my life with what I'm doing as far as coaching goes, I think is for sure the biggest challenge out there for coaches of just about any program in any state in the United States. Because as you said, all you're doing by doing all the things that we just described are you're just staying even with everybody else. Right. And then if you want to go above and beyond, man, you're talking about a huge, huge commitment. And I think that's where, you know, unfortunately you see guys getting out of the profession sometimes because it's just so demanding.
Too much.
Yeah, it's just so demanding. And then there's, you know, you have pressures from whether it's administration, and we all know we can, you know, go back and forth about talking about parents and the influence that they have on their kids. And like we talked about again earlier, that, you know, parents are used to, I paid my $600 and my kid's on the team and they're going to play. And suddenly they get to high school and the coach says, well, no, you're not going to play.
Right.
And that's a difficult conversation to have for somebody who's never had that said to them before. You know, sometimes that can be a struggle too. So I think you're spot on with that time question. I want to go back to talk a little bit about when you were an assistant. So you spent 10 years as an assistant.
Yeah.
Talk about what you, obviously spending 10 years there, there was obviously things about it that you liked being an assistant coach. So if you think back to your time as an assistant, what were some of the positives of being an assistant coach? What did you love about that particular stage of your career?
You know, I kind of got back into it out of loyalty. You know, the Cauga Falls program had kind of taken a little bit of turn after Mike Manier had left, and we weren't having a ton of success. And, you know, I always liked Rob Sloan. I had known him before that. And when he got the job, he kind of struggled through his first year. And the next year, an opportunity came up to kind of join him as his assistant. And, you know, I wanted to be a part of that, you know, teaching in the district at that point for, you know, 10, 12, 13 years at that point. I knew most of the kids, had most of them at some point, you know, in the youth program, and just kind of wanted to be a part of, you know, if we were going to be able to turn this thing around, I wanted to have a hand in it. And, you know, we didn't have a ton of success the first 5 or 6 years, but, you know, fortunately Rob's son, Jay, was coming up through at the same time. And, you know, when he hit the high school level, you know, he played some JV as a freshman, started for us as a sophomore on the varsity. And we had two other really good sophomores at that time. And, you know, we kind of built the end of my time there, you know, was turning things around pretty good. I didn't stay for their senior year. That was my first year at Woodridge, but, you know, they made it to the district that year, which was a big accomplishment for a program that was winning, you know, 5 to 7 games a year consistently for, you know, about a 6 year period. So, it was tough. The losing was, you know, really tough to deal with, but you find ways to kind of find some satisfaction. You know, we had a lot of great kids go through the program, kids that I still see today who are grown men now with families. And, you know, you still look back on it and you can still smile and you know, share a handshake or a hug. That means a lot. You know, Rob was always a people person with our kids, and, you know, my kind of style didn't always mesh with his, but we seemed to complement each other. And I liked working for the guy. I always did. I didn't agree with everything he did, but I liked working for him. And I had a lot of fun as an assistant coach. And, you know, I don't think I realized it at the time, but, you know, it's totally different when you're sitting in that first chair. you know, I had it easy as an assistant coach. I think I made more money. I know I spent about half the time I spend now, and nobody blamed us for losing. So. Or nobody blamed me for losing. Let's just put it that way.
Understood.
Now in that first chair, things are a little bit different.
Hey, Hoopheads Nation, check out this new offering from Tyler Whitcomb Basketball Coaching Courses. The Eric Musselman Arkansas Playbook by Nate Hinkle is now available. Musselman is the head men's basketball coach at the University of Arkansas. He's also a former NBA head coach with the Sacramento Kings and Golden State Warriors. Visit coachtube.com/users/Tyler Whitcomb to check out this great resource.
How does, first of all, how does the opportunity to go to Woodridge as the head coach, how does that come to pass? And then when you get the job, what are some of the first things that you start thinking about in terms of putting together your own program after having been a part of other programs underneath other coaches for so long? I'm sure you had thoughts as you were going through that. Hey, if I ever end up being a head coach, these are some things that I might want to think about. So just talk about how the opportunity came to you and then what you started thinking about immediately after you got the job or even as you're in the interview process.
You know, the job was open in 2011. And I had my resume in an envelope and I had it sealed and I had the postmark on it and I didn't send it. And, I still to this day couldn't tell you why. It just, something about it didn't feel right. When the job opened again, the summer of 13, Don Ross was the athletic director, at Woodridge at the time, and he was just getting ready to retire. And I had worked with Don Ross. He had been the football coach at Cauga Falls, all through the 90s and had a lot of success. And he's a man that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. And I kind of thought to myself, you know what, if I don't apply right now, there may not be a head job. Because I thought, honestly, with Don Ross sitting in the meeting, I'd had a chance. So I sent my stuff over and, you know, fortunately I got an interview and, they interviewed, I believe, 4 or 5 people for the job. And, day after the interview, he asked me to meet him at Applebee's and he offered me the job and he resigned the next day. So I told him I was the easiest hire he ever made. He got to retire and nobody was going to be able to blame him for this because it wasn't on his head. So
there you go.
At that point, you know, it was already midsummer. I already felt like we were behind. My first kind of course of action was to just kind of evaluate what the overall program was like. So I kind of, you know, I met with some of my middle school coaches and kind of got a feel for some of my kids and kind of got a feel for what was going on at the high school level. You know, they weren't terrible. I knew a lot of the kids who were getting ready to come through the program, which was a nice little bonus for me. Mason Leidick, who ended up being the leading career scorer at Woodridge, is playing at Marietta right now, was a kid that was in my youth program over at Cauga Falls. So I knew what I was getting. I wasn't coming to an empty cupboard by any means. It was just kind of, you know, getting a coaching staff in place, you know, getting that middle school kind of squared away. And then it was focusing on younger kids. And, you know, I get a lot of credit for our youth program, but I have to be honest with you, I've done very little with it. We've had some fantastic gentlemen that have kind of directed and coached our kids and, you know, got them involved in travel basketball, got them involved in AAU basketball. And, you know, I think Dave Close would be the first person to tell you over at Stowe, you know, he's got almost 600 wins. You know, his youth program created a lot of that for him. Without a lot of his input. And, you know, my situation is very similar to that. I've got a very strong youth program that brings me zero headaches, but sends me a lot of really good basketball players. So I'm pretty fortunate.
All right. So describe what that looks like. Cause I know that's one of the things that, especially for young coaches who are out there that are just maybe getting their first job or inexperienced. And I think sometimes we forget that when you get hired to coach, be a varsity basketball coach, that you're not just coaching your varsity team, that you are now the head of a program. Sure. And so just talk a little bit about how the program is set up and why it's worked so well for you guys.
Because of the people involved. You know, I've had, I believe this is the second, we have a rec association that runs everything for our kids from second to sixth grade. In my 7 years, this is only the second basketball director I've had. The first one was there, the first five, the gentleman that's in there now has been in there for 2 years. You know, ironically, you know, both of their sons are very good players in my program. But they've managed to, you know, stick around and help build the program and keep kids excited about it. You know, we do a lot with our kids in the summer. Obviously, you know, we run a youth camp that grows in numbers every year. I believe we had almost 80 kids last year. I think the first year we ran it, we might have had 30. You know, just get people excited about being basketball players. You know, fortunately for us, a year ago, we opened a brand new facility. It's a beautiful place to come watch a game. A lot of our kids, our younger kids, come out and they come to games on Tuesdays and Fridays like you and I did when we were little. And you know, that just it builds your brand, you know, and it builds excitement and being a Woodridge basketball player someday. And, you know, a lot of our kids, they're looking forward to that opportunity. And, you know, fortunately for us, I've got great kids at the high school level. Maybe not necessarily great basketball players at all times, but they're such positive examples for our young kids, and they take time and they spend time with them. And, you know, those are the guys that these third and fourth graders look up to. And, you know, when they get an opportunity to sit next to a Josh Decker or a Josh Fleming and share a couple words, that builds our program more than I ever could.
I think that's a key. And I think it's something that is missing in a lot of places today, Rick. I just don't see that being as prevalent as it was, again, back in the day when you and I were coming through. I know that I grew up going to games just like you did. And I remember I tell people all the time, the one thing that I wanted to be able to do from the time I was in elementary school was I wanted to run out to the fight song, and I wanted to be able to slap the backboard on a layup like the high school guys, you know, that I was watching. That was what I wanted. Sure. I wanted to slap that backboard. And sure. I think in a lot of cases, you know, by building that relationship between the kids who are on your varsity team and those younger kids who are coming up, you said it yourself, you create this desire, this aura around what it means to be a part of the Bulldog basketball program and what right. that means. And when kids aspire to that, it gives them something to shoot for. And I think in a lot of cases, especially with the way that the basketball system is today, where kids are, they're playing for AAU teams, they have a lot of different coaches, they have a lot of different people in their ear. There's still, just like we talked about earlier with college basketball transfers, the number of kids in high school who are looking around and saying, oh, maybe I should go to this school or that school. And I think the more that you can do as a high school coach, and this goes to your other point about the amount of time you spend, you know, you're spending a lot of time cultivating those relationships with younger kids to keep those kids in your program and to have them aspiring to be a part of your varsity program as they come up through the school system. And to me, that's just, it's so important. The youth program is so critical to the success of ultimately the varsity program. And I think that sometimes, especially as a young coach, and I think I probably would have been guilty of this back had I been a head coach, I probably would have focused on my team that was in front of me and maybe not looked as closely at those youth kids. But I think when a youth kid has a third or fourth grade game and the varsity coach shows up, or there's varsity players that come to the game, or you're showing up at a middle school game to watch those kids play, I just think that, yeah, it means a lot. And those kids and those parents don't forget that. And then conversely also, I mean, it helps you obviously to get to know those kids before they get to your program, so you already have a relationship with them, which allows you then to coach them harder because they know you care about them and you've cared about them since they were in second grade,
right?
As opposed to when they first show up as a freshman and that's the first time that you're meeting them. And I just think that that youth piece of it is critically important. What are some other things that you think that you've done well that have helped you to build your program into kind of what you had envisioned it when you first got the job?
I don't know if it's quite there yet. I think consistency, you know, throughout our levels, you know, starting at seventh grade, you know, our kids may not run the same stuff we run at the high school level, but there are some things that are characteristic of all of our teams. You know, the way that we teach defense, the way that we teach the fast break or transition, those are things that are consistent from seventh grade all the way to the varsity level. I think it's important to have those middle school kids, you know, when they come to a game and they watch us running stuff, we're running the same stuff they are. You know, maybe there's a wrinkle or two here or there, you know, depending on the level. But I think just having some consistency, that way when those kids get to the high school level, they already have a pretty good understanding of most of the things that we do in our program. So there's not a whole lot of culture shock there. You know, I don't get a lot of mine. I didn't know it was going to be this tough, you know, that type of thing.
Right, right.
You know, I have a couple of middle school coaches who do a heck of a good job for me, and they've done it for quite a while. My freshman or my seventh grade coach is new this year, but he's a guy who, you know, was a varsity girls head coach 5 years ago. So he's very knowledgeable, and these guys understand. And, you know, kind of when I talked about being a JV coach and not doing a good job of preparing my guys for the next step, I think that the two guys that I have in place right now do a fantastic job of preparing the guys for their next step. And it's allowed us, you know, we see a lot of turnover, at least early in my career at Woodridge. We saw a lot of turnover losing guys from the eighth to ninth grade level. And now we're not seeing that as much anymore. These kids are still, you know, they're interested in being a part of the program. So I think the consistency definitely helps with that. You know, just being true to what you are, you know, especially with when our kids are the way our kids are involved and the way that we try to treat our kids. You know, we try to give our kids the best of everything, you know, when it comes to uniforms, travel gear, that type of stuff. But, you know, we tell them on a regular basis, hey, listen, you're not being given anything. You're earning these things. And, you know, that's kind of true throughout our program.
How do you get that mission across to the middle school coaches, the coaches on your staff? How do you get everybody on the same page? Is that through face-to-face talks? Do you get out on the floor with them and show them, hey, this is what we want to do it. This is what we want to run. This is how we do it. How do you go about making sure that there's that consistency from the very beginning of your staff all the way up to yourself as the head coach?
Well, first of all, they've got to be willing to do it, you know, as coaches. And, you know, sometimes that's a hard time. You'll have guys who have a hard time accepting things like that, you know, hey, here's the way I've done it forever. And, you know, we've had a lot of success. So they have to be willing to do that. But we have a very hands-on approach with our middle school guys. You know, when it comes to tryouts for those guys, my high school staff and I run we've run two out of the 3 days of tryouts. I just let my coaches sit and evaluate. The second day, the middle day for them, I let them run it and I do the evaluating that day. But yeah, we have a meeting every year at the beginning of the year. You know, we kind of go through the things that, you know, that we want to put in, the things that we want the kids to have some type of understanding of. And we make ourselves available to them. You know, I spend a lot of time at the middle school. My assistant coaches do. My coaches at the middle school level spend a lot of time, you know, after their practice is over, they'll come up and watch some of ours. And if they need to see something, we'll show it to them. So, you know, we just kind of, everybody's kind of held accountable to that. And, you know, like I said at first, you got to be willing to do it first. And fortunately, my guys are.
That's awesome. How do you engage the parents in your program? How do you get them involved and keep them, you know, keep them actively supporting the program? Because we all know as coaches out there that parents can sometimes, they're focused on the needs of their kid first and the needs of the team second, whereas a coach is focused on the needs of the team first and the needs of the kid second. So just talk a little bit of how you keep parents engaged and on your side and supportive of the program. What are some things that you've done that have been successful over the years?
Well, if we're going to talk about the things I've done that have been unsuccessful, that would take us a little longer. Let's just say, you know, the big thing for me is communication. I try to do a really good job of keeping our parents in the loop about what's going on. Anything that we tell the kids, you know, when it comes to something as simple as a schedule change, I make sure it gets emailed out in the next 5 minutes. You got to be transparent about what you're doing. Any conversation that you're going to have with the kid, you better be prepared to have with dad. And it's probably not a bad idea if you do have a hard conversation with a kid to call dad that night and talk to him about it. Be transparent about it. You know, for us, you know, we're a smaller district. We don't have a ton of money. We're forced to raise quite a bit of money to do some of the things that we want to do. I try to rely on my parents for as little as possible when it comes to that. You know, we try to get outside businesses involved. I try to get, you know, a lot of my friends involved who don't have a connection to the Woodridge basketball program. Those types of things. I try to ease that burden on them as much as I can. But I don't know, man. It's a work in progress. Every set of parents is different. A lot of it has to do with winning and losing. You know, I had a lot more parent issues in year one than I did in year five. You know, we're 8-8 right now. I don't know that I have parent issues, but I might. They haven't brought them to me yet. We are having some issues within our own group, but there's some things that, you know, I attribute a lot of it to growing pains. So, you know, mostly we've got a pretty prideful community. It's a community that supports all of our sports. You know, we don't get overflow crowds. We get nice crowds. You know, when we travel on the road, we might only have 125 people there, but they're loud and they make noise and, you know, they're excited about us seeing us be successful. And, you know, all a parent ever wants is to see their kid, you know, excel at something and have a positive experience. And, you know, that's no different than my expectations for them. You know, I want our guys to excel. I want them to have a positive experience. I want them to look back when they're 30 years old and remember being a basketball player at Woodridge was, you know, one of the better times that they had growing up. But more importantly than that, you know, you put all the winning and losing aside. I want them to be good husbands. I want them to be, you know, good dads, and I want them to be basketball coaches someday.
How do you help to foster that team camaraderie amongst the players, the relationships between teammates? Is there anything that you do from a team bonding type things that,
yeah, we do that some you things, can share? You know, we call them team building stuff, and, you know, it's getting tougher and tougher. Just because of the way our schedule is now, the 22 games really makes it tough because, you know, your opportunities to do these things, you got to really kind of plan ahead. But, you know, we have a day where we go out and we bowl and, you know, we do one of those things. We have a little competition amongst the team. And then, you know, last year we were able to take our guys out to a nice lunch and go watch Mount Union play. You know, we do things like that. Saturday mornings, my guys have a shortened practice. We are only on the floor for about 30 minutes, and then we do yoga as a group. I have a yoga instructor come in. You know, things where they have a different voice in front of them instead of just me, and you know, allow them to kind of spend some time with each other and do some things where there's, you know, there's no whistle involved and there's no screaming and yelling. There's, you know, we can laugh and I try to get in there with them and have a little bit of fun too, so that they can see I'm more than, you know, just what they see on most days, Monday through Friday. But I'm a person too, and, you know, try to build those relationships and, you know, just, hey, be there for your kids, man. Just, you know, be involved in what they do. I mean, if you listen to anything, you know, about Urban Meyer or Ryan Day and the Ohio State football program, and, you know, when they talk about recruiting, they talk about the fact that they're not in there selling Ohio State. They're trying to build relationships with these guys, and, you know, I don't do it at their level by any means, but, you know, when I have a conversation with kids off the floor, I'm trying not to talk about basketball. I want to talk about other things. I want to talk about, you know, girlfriend, the ACT test coming up. How's your little sister doing? You know, those types of things. Those things matter. The kids need to see you as something more than just a basketball coach.
Yeah, I think that's 100% right. And I think that you mentioned earlier that when you think back to the guys that have played for you and then they come back to you and they talk to you and they share things with you and you get that phone call, hey coach, I'm getting married, or hey coach, I got a new job, or hey coach, I got a question for you. To me, that's always one of the things that is the most valuable about being a coach. It's one of the most satisfying pieces of being a coach. I don't think there's anything better than that, than getting that call. And, you know, we all know that the coaches that I played for, I would only ever call him coach. And even though I'm almost a 50-year-old guy, anybody that I've ever seen that I played for, you know, there's no way I'd be walking up to them and calling them by their first name. You know, you still call them coach. You still have that level of respect for them. And I think that's what we're all striving for as coaches. We're coming up close to an hour and a half here, Rick. I want to give you a chance before we get out of here to share your contact information. So if anybody's listened tonight and wants to reach out to you and ask a question or just say thanks for being on with us, I'd like you to do that. And then if there's anything that we didn't touch on or any parting words of wisdom that you want to give before we get out, you can go ahead and do that. And then I'll jump back on and wrap things up.
All right. R. Blevins, B-L-E-V-I-N-S, at woodridge.k12.oh.us. That's my email. On Twitter, at Rick Blevins or at Woodridge Hoops. I'm available on both. We follow up on both of those on a pretty much daily basis. Other than that, Mike, I appreciate your time. It's been great catching up with you a little bit this month. And you and Harold Walton were a blessing my senior year. I didn't know what we were going to do at the guard position. And for two freshmen, you guys held, you more than held your own. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, we tried, and it was a fun group. It was a fun group, and it was a fun group. And like I said earlier, I meant it that I just felt like you know, the pieces fit together. And there's obviously, as we talked about, some regrets in terms of what we maybe came up short in terms of what we wanted to accomplish. But I think that, you know, I look back on those years just like you do as fond memories. And I told you the story when we kind of got reconnected here that I still remember. You were my first roommate on my first road trip when we went out to Virginia. And
Thanksgiving weekend.
Exactly. Walking around Charlottesville, and I'm trying to decide, are we going to buy a Virginia basketball sweatshirt? Should we buy this? Should we not buy it? Still, I'll never forget that. And I think one of the things that you always appreciate and what I always look back on is, you know, I think about the different teams I've played on. If you think about the upperclassmen, the guys that are a little bit older than you and kind of take you under their wing and treat you right. And I always felt like you and, to be honest, everybody that was a part of the program, when you come in as a freshman, you never know quite what to expect. And you were always good to me along with other people. So I want you to know that, you know, that I do appreciate it. I do remember it. And those are some of the best memories that, you know, I'm going to carry those with me to my grave. Let's put it that way. So it's been a pleasure getting reconnected. And I think we're going to stay connected from this point forward. I can't thank you enough for spending nearly an hour and a half with us tonight. It's been great. I think you shared a lot of things that coaches out there are going to benefit from. And I can't thank you enough for being a part of the Hoopheads podcast. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Registration is now open at headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps for boys and girls in grades 1 through 6 throughout the greater Cleveland area. Get registered today and make sure you hit the courts with us this summer.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.